Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, wherever you get your shows.
Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. In political news this week, the Trump administration has created a nearly $1.8 billion fund to compensate people who say they were unfairly targeted by previous administrations. The so-called anti-weaponization fund came about through a lawsuit settlement between the Internal Revenue Service, Trump himself, and one of his sons over unauthorized disclosure of Trump's tax information years ago. The one-page document, signed by the acting attorney general appointed by Trump, says that the government would be forever barred and precluded from prosecuting or pursuing pending tax claims against Mr. Trump, his family members, and businesses. Here's more on the controversy surrounding this from KCBS in San Francisco.
Mark Sandolo. Mark, good morning. I know there's an effort in Congress to try to block money from going to people who took part in the January 6th attack, but are there votes there to derail this plan?
This is the problem, Steve, that Republicans in Congress face. I mean, I think that there's widespread outrage at this deal, which looked pretty questionable, if not outright corrupt, when it was announced on Monday. But as details have come out, it has looked even far worse in that, you know, that Trump made a deal with the IRS to drop his $10 billion lawsuit in exchange for creating this fund to pay back victims. Well, it turns out that the IRS had an internal memo saying they were confident that Trump's lawsuit was not going to be successful, that they had very, very strong terms to beat that lawsuit. And on top of that, it was revealed that the IRS or the Justice Department agrees that Trump will not be prosecuted for any tax fraud or any member of his family forever, which sounds like something that is on its face unconstitutional and not legal to do. So what Congress go back to your original question about what steps can be taken. I mean, Congress, the problem Republicans face is that they look at what happened on Tuesday night and a couple of Tuesdays ago, where in primary elections, those candidates who have stood up to Trump in the past on other things, you know, like the Epstein files, got creamed and they got lost their seats. Long-term incumbents lost their seats because Donald Trump opposed them. So now they're standing there on the one hand hearing their constituents saying this deal does not seem right, you ought to stand up to the president. On the other hand, seeing how their colleagues who had stood up to the president in the past are losing their jobs. And as a result, there are a handful of Republicans who are ready to join Democrats in trying to stop this thing, but there certainly aren't hordes of them yet.
Yeah, Mark, less than a minute left here, but you wonder, I mean, will some Republicans, perhaps fearing for their jobs, even if they don't like this fund, kind of hold their nose and stay silent?
Well, certainly that's happened to a large degree. There's been no, you know, there's been a howl of outrage from Democrats, and there certainly has been no howl from Republicans. I mean, the simple steps, you know, Congress is the one that is supposed to allocate all the money, you know, for everything. That's in the Constitution. And there's a constitutional question about how the president can simply create this $1.8 billion fund. And it's due to a law Congress passed a number of years ago so that when they do compensate victims of unfair prosecutions, they don't have to create legislation every time. They basically give the administration leeway to spend up to $100,000 on any individual. Well, that was always questionable, but no president had ever done what this president's doing, which is say, well, we're going to make that a $1.8 billion fund. So the courts might stop this as well. And then the question is, who came up with this? Was this truly Donald Trump with his $1.776 billion fund? Or was it Todd Blanche, his former attorney who represented him in the Stormy Daniels case and all sorts of other cases, who's now the acting attorney general, who appears to be auditioning for the job full time? This definitely has Washington in a tizzy, and people who think that Trump has acted corruptly in the past think that this takes the cake.
So, this case, controversial as it is, was adjudicated by human lawyers. But is the future of law in AI? Here's more from KCBS.
A growing number of Americans are turning to AI for legal representation and help with court cases. But the resulting surge of do-it-yourself lawsuits is overwhelming courts all across the country. Joshua Levy researcher with the University of Southern California's Department of Economics. All right, let's look at this kind of as an introduction. What kind of legal work is AI doing these days?
So my co-author and I have been looking at civil lawsuits in particular, and we find that AI seems to be really loading into cases or helping individual people, pro se litigants representing themselves in court, with cases that seem to be most templatable. These look things like consumer credit disputes and civil rights complaints, but they seem to still fall short of doing really complex litigation, things like patent disputes or securities litigation.
So, I mean, how does this work? Let's say I live in the city and county of San Francisco, and I want to file a lawsuit about, I don't know, whatever. Do I just recite into ChatGPT or one of the other platforms exactly what I want to do, and it'll write up the whole thing for me?
So I have not tried to do this myself, and I suspect that people have tried and done various versions of this, probably to also varying degrees of success. We think that people are often of the mind that they might have a lawsuit, and then they begin asking ChatGPT questions like, how do I file a lawsuit, or what are the best ways for me to get representation? And sometimes AI might say, hey, you don't need a lawyer. You can instead sort of just write up the complaint yourself. There's obviously many stages in between beginning to talk to ChatGPT or to Claude and actually filing a lawsuit, and we don't have a great amount of insight into that, but people clearly seem to be doing it.
Okay, now that seems to make sense. You know, ChatGPT or Claude, do I have a case here? Is you know, should I file a lawsuit? That makes sense. But I mean, when it starts writing up the briefs, we've had stories here on KCBS about, you know, made up cases being entered, you know, into lawsuits and briefs and things like that. I mean, AI isn't always right.
Absolutely. You know, even famous law firms that, you know, get paid thousands of dollars an hour to represent their clients seem to be using AI, making mistakes in this kind of way. So there's definitely a certain amount of buyer beware here. But for people without a lot of money who may not want to, you know, shell out lots and lots of money to a fancy law firm, this sort of low-cost method might be worth the risk to them.
Is it a satisfactory risk? I mean, okay, I don't have a lot of money to spend on lawyers. You know, despite the dangers, is it a good idea?
I'm not sure I would personally recommend it. And of course, it is up to individuals to sort of like make that risk assessment for themselves. I think it is a feature of many of the U.S. courts that judges are supposed to be quite generous to people who are representing themselves. And sort of, you know, if they make some technical errors along the way, the judges are supposed to help them out a little bit. Maybe judges will become less forgiving over time if, you know, these AI-generated cases are really clogging up the courts.
But if a judge then looks at a brief and sees something about Jones versus Santa Clara, and, you know, the judge is smart enough or the judge's clerk is smart enough to know there's no such thing, well, that's not going to help you, right?
No, it certainly isn't. And, you know, judges have started, you know, handing down reprimands, not only to the professional lawyers, but also to the pro se litigants for, you know, submitting filings that do have these kinds of hallucinations or errors in them.
So do we think that this is, in fact, encouraging people to file more lawsuits? Is it actually clogging up the court system?
So using an econ intuition, we're pretty confident that, you know, lowering the cost of something encourages people to do more of it. So we think that there is definitely more AI-generated cases going on, and we see this in the pro se filing share. In terms of clogging up the courts, it appears to be that there's a whole bunch of new pro se lawsuits. In the federal courts, the share of pro se litigation was historically around 10% or 11%. This was very, very stable over the past 2.5 decades. And since the release of ChatGPT, it spiked very, very quickly to around 17% last year. And we don't expect this trend to slow down. So there is some chance that all of these new cases are going to slow down the courts. And that's a problem not only for those pro se litigants, but also for represented ones.
To be clear, for those of us who did not go to law school and perhaps slept through Latin class years ago, pro se means do it yourself?
Oh, excuse me. Yeah. Yes. Self-represented.
Okay. That's what I thought. What are concerns that this could be used in bad faith? Could you use AI to craft a bogus lawsuit or draft some sort of official-looking documents where you hand them in and they look real and so maybe they get it accepted?
So that is maybe a, first concern. I'm not particularly concerned of that kind of thing. Because of the adversarial nature of the courts, there's probably someone on the other side double-checking your work and making sure that it isn't totally bogus. And in the case that it is, that case is probably going to be dismissed very quickly. And just sort of looking at the existing share of outcomes, it does look like a lot of these cases get dismissed very quickly.
Do we have staff that is overseeing this and looking them over and saying, no, no, this doesn't look right?
So judges, of course, have their staff in their chambers. But we can also count a little bit on the adversarial nature of if you're suing someone, that person's probably going to check your work very carefully, or their lawyers are going to check your work very carefully and, you know, quickly sniff out things that don't look right.
Ah, they may have a human lawyer looking over your AI complaint.
Exactly.
We know that AI occasionally has a problem with, we'll call it hallucinations. They'll fabricate facts and citations. Do we know how many times judges have caught lawyers using fake legal citations generated by AI?
So we have a guess because we can only sort of count the people who get caught, for example. There's a researcher at HEC Paris in France who started collecting a database of all the reprimands that have been handed out for these kinds of hallucinations. And you know, I think he's already documented well over 1,000 reprimands. And of course, that's just the floor of the potential use rate.
Are there penalties for, you know, submitting stuff, whether you wrote it yourself or ChatGPT or Claude or whomever, you know, stuff that doesn't exist? I mean, can the judge not just throw out the case, but take action against you?
The judge can do so. There's often some amount of discretion that the judge holds, and they are supposed to treat self-represented litigants slightly more generously than they are professional lawyers. And of course, the professional lawyers are going to pay a huge reputational cost in, you know, being outed by the judge for doing bad work.
A big part of the debate about the president and his so-called anti-weaponization fund is whether the GOP, a party dedicated to being fiscally conservative, will oppose it when members have learned the hard way what happens when the president is displeased with one. That is, you get tossed out of office when he tells red state voters to cast ballots for your opponent. But how ugly and mean do we like our politics to be? Here's Dave Cohen at WWL in New Orleans.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of the Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to the Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We don't have to hate each other. We don't. We don't have to fight. We don't have to be mean. Do we? Because it sure feels like more and more of our elected leaders, more and more of our politicians, more and more of us choose to be mean. Choose to espouse hate. We see it on social media. We see it in political campaigns. We see it in the halls of government. And I'm personally just tired of it. I think it's ugly, it's unnecessary, and it's exhausting. Now, maybe I'm in the minority because the folks who further this kind of mean-spirited political rhetoric seem to be winning more of the election. And so maybe that's what the voters want. Maybe that's what the electorate wants. Maybe that's what our society wants. I don't want it. Do you? Steve, thanks for calling. What do you think? Do we have to be mean to each other?
No, we don't. And, you know, I've been involved in, I'm 71 years old. I've been involved in politics, let's say, since 1980. I graduated law school in 1980 and was involved in many of the local and state campaigns and never had the type of vitriol or the just the nasty commercials that you see on TV every 30 seconds when there's a campaign going on. And after a while, I just decided I didn't want to be involved in it anymore in terms of helping manage campaigns. It was just so toxic, and the relationships that you experience with the opposing side became so toxic and stressful, it just wasn't worth it. number one. That's on the political side.
Why do you think that? Hold on, before we I'll let you get to number two. But number one, why? Why do you think it's become, in your words, so toxic in politics, in campaigning? I heard a disturbing report the other day that apparently lawmakers on Capitol Hill almost never socialize with each other outside their own parties anymore. Maybe within their state delegations, but it used to be totally normal to see Democrats and Republicans out at a bar together or at a restaurant together or attending an event together. And that may have just been anecdotal, and I don't know that anyone studied it, but at least this one report I heard said that just does not happen like it used to, because they literally don't like each other anymore. They literally don't want to spend time together anymore. So why do you think that's changed? Why have politics become, in your words, so toxic?
I think to a great extent, people identify so closely with the positions that their politicians take that they can't admit if they're wrong or that they've made a mistake, because they think it says something about themselves personally. It's almost an attack on their own self-worth, that they couldn't possibly admit that the person they chose for office is wrong or has taken an incorrect position. And so
we support them no matter what.
Correct. And I'll give you a classic example. First of all, I'll preface this statement by saying that I am what I would call now a moderate Democrat, conservative on fiscal issues, but liberal on social issues. And I look at what happened to Senator Kennedy, Senator Cassidy, who probably voted with Trump 95% of the time, including his support for Robert Kennedy.
Yeah, but did he just give Robert Kennedy his support because he knew his election was coming up and he knew that he had voted to impeach the president during his first term and he thought that was politically wise? Or did he do that because he really thought Robert Kennedy should be the health secretary?
No, I agree with you. I think he voted for Kennedy because he knew he had to somehow undo his impeachment vote. But the point that I was trying to make was, here's the guy who had seniority in the Senate, which was of benefit overall to the state of Louisiana, even though he made that one impeachment vote. And yet 80% of the voters voted against him. People cannot possibly choose not to support what Donald Trump wants.
In this environment of deeply divided politics, are we surprised when people choose not to run for office, even locally? Here's WBEN in upstate New York.
I'm Susan Rose.
I'm Brian Masurowski.
School budget votes passed overwhelmingly in Western New York yesterday, with a few exceptions. Budgets failed in Grand Island, Lindenville, Randolph, and West Valley. Districts have two options. They can either put the same budget or a revised budget up for a second vote, or immediately adopt a contingency budget. This year also saw fewer candidates running for school boards across the region. There were only 11 contested school board elections in Erie and Niagara counties out of 38 school districts.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.